Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
But meanwhile, all is a shadow cast by a dream. And to the musing and immobile spirit, life in himself donned the aspect of a myth, the burden of a long, unmeaning tale. For the key is hid, and by the inconscient kept, the secret God beneath the threshold dwells. In a body obscuring the immortal spirit, a nameless resident vesting unseen powers with matter's shapes and motives beyond thought and the hazard of an unguessed consequence, an omnipotent, indiscernible influence he sits, unfelt by the form in which he lives, and veils his knowledge by the groping mind. A wanderer in a world his thoughts have made. He turns in a chiaroscuro of error and truth to find a wisdom that on high is his. As one forgetting, he searches for himself. As if he had lost an inner light, he seeks. As a sojourner lingering amid alien scenes, he journeys to a home he knows no more. His own self's truth he seeks, who is the truth. He is the player who became the play. He is the thinker who became the thought. He is the many who was the silent one. In the symbol figures of a cosmic force, and in her living and inanimate signs, and in her complex tracery of events, he explores the ceaseless miracle of himself, till the thousandfold enigma has been solved in the single light of an all-witnessing soul. Yes. Now I read to you a little poem out of India. Only a connoisseur of the flavors of love can comprehend the language of a lover's heart. Others have no clue. The taste of lime rests in the core of the fruit, and even experts know of no easy way to reach it. Honey is hidden within the lotus bloom, but the bee knows it. Dung beetles nestle in dung, discounting honey. Submission is the secret of knowledge. Now, there is in India a very little known religious sect, and they are called the Baul's, B-A-U-L, Baul. And it means affected by the wind. They are people of music, of dance, and of poetry, and this is one of their little ones. And at one time, over at Palomar, I was giving a talk there one day, a woman came up afterwards and spoke to me, and she seemed to be quite well educated and very well traveled and interested in all the different forms of religion, you know, like a bee. Here's a daisy, here's a rose, and here's a, you know, taste and flea. And her, but her comment was that in India, I had mentioned India somewhere in the thing, and she said that in India, in her travels, that of all the sects in India with whom she had come in contact, the Baals impressed her the most. Very simple people, huh? They sometimes live in small ashrams. and the guru will visit one ashram after another. Or maybe this guru will just have one ashram and he will be there all the time. Maybe a particular section won't have any ashrams at all. These people just mill around. And like the Sufis, you know, and they are called the Sufis of India. They're the mystics of India, they're called. Dance is part of their lives, and music is part of their lives. So they have the dance and the music and the music and the song, and this is the vowels, and they express themselves this way. They do not have any scriptures that they turn to every day and read and, you know, and say all this and that and the other. And also, they do not use the term God. They have instead the term Adhar Manush, which is the essential man or the essential being, Adhar Manush. The Adhar Manush within you, the essential man within you. You know, within me, within everyone, yeah. The essential being. And to find that Adhar Manush in me, this essential man, that's the whole of their search, the whole of their religion. And for this, they don't need the scriptures. And the way to this essential man, they say, is to go through the Sahaja Manush, or the man of great spontaneity. The spontaneous man. Well, so that's first on the list, huh? Spontaneity. So in order to be spontaneous, one must at least shed oneself of one's burdens. How else are you going to be innocent and full of fun and, you know, like a child, all this energy, huh? Yeah. They do not have an organization such as we find in Zen or we find in Vedanta or Christianity or Christian Science or whatever, you know. And maybe that's why we don't hear very much about them. How many of you have ever heard of the vowels? Nobody. Says so hot, doesn't it? There is this lack of ritual. There is this lack of organization. There is this lack of tradition, such as we mill around in all the time, huh? And this lack of all of this, ritual, tradition, scripture, it leaves them free just to be themselves, the individual. So they have this individual search for truth, which we all do anyway. Everybody goes there, you know, is searching in their own way. We are all different, so we do search, but we search within certain confines. In a way they do too, but not. They say, you know, that everyone has to tread the path alone. You sit for meditation alone, even though you sit with a group. It's alone. How else would you do, like Plotinus said, and have this flight from the alone to the alone? Yeah. You eat alone, nobody else can fill your stomach. You breathe alone, nobody else can fill your lungs. You know. You sleep alone. I don't care how many people are in bed with you, you're still sleeping alone. You go alone in your way to find your way. And the way you go in this search creates your way. It is not already there, you know, that everybody can just jump on and say, oh, now I'm on the way. You know. Yeah. You walk. And you create the way. You know, it's kind of like we're lost in a forest. What do you do if you're lost in a forest? You know, you haven't got a map. You haven't got a compass. You know, there's no path anywhere indicating to go this way. There's nothing. Nothing leading anywhere. There's just trees and trees and trees and trees, and then more trees. So, what do you do when you look within? What do you see? Well, you see concepts and prejudices and values. You know, all these trees standing in the way of your spontaneity. So, in a way, we are lost in a forest of trees. What to do? Well, you start walking. You just do. You start searching. You start seeking. And if you do this, this searching and this seeking, this going within, you create a path to the top of the mountain. Didn't remind me to ask her. I thanked him. Anyway, the road, he's fixing the road. Now, in the family life, or just ordinary family life in India, many people still following the native religion, which when the Aryans came from the north, you know, the Aryans found these people, these natives, and they came 20,000 years ago. And they had a religion of a type, these natives. It was a very practical form of devotion, and it was never written out. It is not really today. But it is still very alive today, you see. It's founded on the relationship that exists between woman, that is, she who embodies the power of Shakti, between woman and earth. Now, Shakti is the name of a primordial energy, the force, a force of the divine. It is the divine in action, so to speak. She's also called the feminine aspect of the one. And in the Chinese and the Japanese tradition, she is named Kuan Yin or Kuanon. In the American and European tradition, she is known as the Holy Spirit or the Virgin Mother. She, Athena, who sprang from the forehead of Zeus, you know. Not all, nothing new, you know. The yin and the yang, too, you see. The masculine and the feminine. There is this Shakta and Shakti. And this is the basis of Tantra. We have Hindu Tantra now, and we have Tibetan Tantra, you know, this holy couple, this divine mother. She is Bina, who pours her grace and her blessings on all those who call upon her. She is the divine mother that is found in the temples, and she is seated on private altars, and she is enclosed in amulets that these natives wear. Isis, the mother of Horus. 1,000 names she has, And she ruled the Aborigines of India. Yeah. And rules today, still many of them. She is the cow. That's why the cow is sacred, this divine mother, see, the giving mother. And Hathor in Egypt, you know, is the woman with the head of the cow. All mother, all Shakti, all this divine power. Now, when these Vedic Aryans, and it is thought that these Aryans brought the Vedas with them, So the Vedas then would be more than 20,000 years old because they came 20,000 years ago. See, and these Aryans that went to India, they were running away from the cold. The glaciers were moving and it was cold there. And some of them, of course, stayed and fought it through. So we have the Aryans in Europe, and then we have the Aryans in India. Mm-hmm. Now, when they came to India, these Aryans, they formed an aristocracy. They were the priests and the warriors. And they mingled with these aborigines and they took over. And they were the aristocracy, not the natives. And they, out of the Vedas, you see, they worship the spiritual principle of sunlit life. Life, the light of the sun, the sunlit life. And they had rituals for this that was very far beyond the understanding of these natives. So, but naturally, these natives wanted to partake in the thing too, and they wanted to worship the sun also. You know, they didn't want to be left out. And so these simple people, they put in their drawings, you know, they put human features to their drawings of the sun, and so he became called Vishnu the Radiant, you know, in this triumvirate of Brahm, Vishnu, and Shiva. Now, this Vishnu, the Radiant, he had a son, and his son was called Krishna. And Krishna couldn't accept his father's throne. So he was a warrior. He came out of the warrior caste, and a warrior cannot be a king. So Krishna could never accept the throne from his father. So he sided with the people, the natives, you see. And he denounced the rituals. They didn't need to do them. And he denounced the sacrifices. He denounced everything from which he was excluded. Right on, huh? But it is said of him that he wanted to be free. You know. But he wanted to have this freedom and the spontaneity, and he wanted to know what it was all about. But he didn't want to become a sannyasin. That is, a sadhu, a disciple. Pure and simple, he just didn't want to be disciplined. He didn't want to be trained. Even though he praises it to the rooftops in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, this Krishna. Because of his denouncing the rituals, which the natives couldn't join in, actually, and not wanting to discipline himself, he personified the way to liberation for the oppressed, see, for the poor, those who thought they had no means to strive for freedom. He became their, shall we say, high chief? Yeah, the one. Now, the story of Krishna has been passed on, through oral tradition long before it was ever written. And he is represented as having been taken by force from his royal surroundings and put into a small boat like Moses. He floats off into the sunset. And then Krishna, you know, he rose out of the waters of this sea, you know, and the villagers found him. He is the child god, you know, as Jesus was. And there are many other similarities. There is even said that they think that the word Christ comes from the word Krishna. In the Gita, he is the Lord who teaches. And his greatness is in the transforming, the daily transforming, transforming existence with all its suffering into sacrifice for the love of the one. Everything you do is for this one. He transforms everything. So thanks to him, the poorest man, even though starving, hungry, beggared, dressed in rags, he can play his little flute and he can sing his songs of love without complaint, because he is transforming everything into love, like Krishna. No discipline. Because one of the aspects of Krishna, of course, is devotion. This is the bhakti yoga. And through devotion, you see, this is the submission. Through submission, the secret knowledge. Now, the Aryans, the direct descendants of which there are still some around in India, a small group of them. Bodhidharma is thought to have been one of these descendants because he had the blue eyes and he was fair, he had a red beard. Now, out of these Aryans that came to India these 20,000 years ago, after a little while, there were some of these that decided they didn't want to have all of this Vedic authority over them all the time. And the Vedic authority, of course, is very strict. It governs everything you do, everything you think. There's a ritual for every minute of the day. You know, the Rig Veda's, you know, is only the beginning. There's Ayurveda, which is the healing, and, you know, it governs everything, you know. But here now we come to these rebels. They decided they don't want to follow this kind of authority that much. So they were persecuted. And they were driven out of the villages as undesirable nomads. And they went away and they settled on the eastern boundaries of India with all their free thought and their democratic way of life, you know, without gods, without kings, without castes. You look at that frame, you know, picture, you know, this free living. Don't picture hippies. <Mm-mm>. They weren't hippies. But they had this free thought, you know, and very democratic, as I say, way of life. And then you take a turn from that and you look at this other picture of life being lived under this Vedic authority. And you can see, we can readily see how independent thought has been suppressed in India since these Vedic times. You can't think for yourself. The Vedas do it all. And if you want to know what to do, you go ask the guru who is versed in the Vedas. So they don't think for themselves. But at the same time, you see, this independence, you know, is like a current. It's like a force. It's a subterranean thing. And it inspires us. And it causes flames to spring up every now and then. They're quickly extinguished, but here comes another one, and here comes another one, see? And some of these flames that spring up have great strength, like Sri Ramana Maharshi. Independent thinker in India. Yeah. Now these rebels, these independent souls, are known in history as the Vratyas. V-R-A-T-Y-A-S, Vratya. And in India, they are referred to with great contempt. Much, you know, like the tradition holds the Gnostics. You know, the Gnostics are held in great contempt by the church proper. And young ministers to be and young priests to be are taught that the Gnostics died out 300 years ago. Well, I'm standing here. Yeah. Because Gnosticism remains. I had a young fellow, the fellow that put in the electricity out front over there at that, you know. Here he's very interested in what we're doing, and so he would like to come and see me. So he comes to the house, and then he informs me he's a Lutheran minister. And so then, you know, what's all this Gnosticism business? It died out 300 years ago. No, it didn't. No, it didn't, you know. And he didn't know where to go with that, and I didn't know what to do with him. Anyway, this is this flame that rises. Anyway, and as time went by in India, there was this great silence that fell upon this whole subject of these people that had moved out to the boundaries, these rebels. Rebels from the Vedas. This little minority who had dared to defy the Vedic teachings. Yeah. And they believed in a great being who could be described only negatively. And they had a little saying. In the beginning, there was the One. And from Him, everything emanated. See, like the Gnostics, they had this emanation theory. Everything, they had the nine things, like Plotinus, you know. In the beginning, there was the One. From Him, everything emanated. He who knows this Vratya is called Vidvan Vratya. That's where he got his name. Well, he spelled it differently. It's V-I-D instead of Vidvan, V-I-T, Vidvan. One who knows that essential being. I thought you might be interested. Now, this great being was to them the great exemplar. He was the example that we should follow. He was the prototype of the liberated man. He was a Shaiva monk. And he roamed the country. And this rebel, you know, that had nothing but his clothes on his back, his robes, and this little gourd that he had, which was his begging bowl, and it's out of this bowl that he ate and he drank. And these monks so impressed the people, the natives and everything, that they became the prototype for the people. This was their ideal, to be like that, you see. There also at this time wandered, equally free from all social rules, the counterpart monks out of the same rebellion. But they had now this man in the heart. The man in the heart. This is an inner state which can be obtained only by personal discipline. They were the Baals. There was no caste distinction, no temple. They worshiped no god. They made no pilgrimage to sacred places. Rebels. When India was invaded by Islam back in the 11th century, the Sufis of all the lines of descent, and they are many, you know, all these teachers, you know, they set up all these lines, all these lines of descent of the Sufis, they joined the Baals and they became like one family, singing the same songs, making the same music, doing the same dances. Yeah. And they followed the same precepts. To submit to and obey the man seated in the temple of the heart. Of course, remember, you've got to find him first. Mm-hmm. You just can't willy-nilly go and say, well, I think this is what he's saying. I know he's telling me this. And no, no, no. There is an experience where you actually see this man in the temple. Yeah. And then to respect the secrets of others, to use money simply and without attachment, to expend themselves for the good of others, to show themselves strong among those who are strong, and to show themselves in their humbleness before those who are weak. Now the Shaiva monk that I mentioned first, he represents the Purusha aspect, the masculine aspect. Huh? And the Baal monk represents Pakrit, the feminine aspect of the same spiritual discipline, which is Samkhya Yoga. The Baal travels in the void, in which all objects resound. O Bhagavan, O Lord of the heart. So sing the Baals, the Sufis of India. Only a connoisseur of the flavors of love can comprehend the language of a lover's heart. Others have no clue. The taste of lime rests at the core of the fruit, and even experts know of no easy way to reach it. Honey is hidden within the lotus bloom, but the bee knows it. Dung beetles nestle in the dung, discounting honey. Submission is the secret of knowledge. See? Love can be known only by loving. It's not something that can be made comprehensible through discussion. You can talk until you're blue in the face, and somebody who knows nothing about love is still not going to understand any more than he's going to know what the taste of sugar is without tasting it, huh? Yeah, because love is not a theory at all. Love is not mental at all. It may trigger all kinds of mental things, but, you know, love itself is love. So, first off, there are things we can know only by doing or by being. You know, it's really quite simple. If you don't know swimming, you know, you don't know how to swim, you don't know what it is. You can picture yourself, you know, going like this through the water, but you don't know how the water feels on your body. If you don't know how to swim, you don't know anything about swimming. You can listen to 1,000 swimmers talk, but you're still not going to know any more about swimming. So you have to learn to swim in order to know swimming. And then you get to the edge of the water and you look at it and you say, well, I'm not going to step into that river unless I know about swimming first. If I don't know about swimming first, I'm going to drown if I get in that river. I'm going to know about swimming first before I get in the river. How can I step into the river if I don't know how to swim? I must know swimming. Then I can step into the river. But then you will never, ever be able to know swimming, because to learn swimming, you have to step into the river. What do you call it, catch 22? Yeah. That's where you're at. Huh? You know, we cannot spend our lives selling water by the river to those who want to know how to swim. We give a little push. The rest of you can sell water by the river. Not you here, those out there. The world of the Baal is an accepting world. It includes everything, and so it is a very rich world. Life as it is totally accepted. That's the way it is, you see. And this, at the same time, does not mean that one simply indulges. That does not necessarily make life rich. one observes. Always it comes back to that, one observes. And as I go through a little bit more of this, why we're going to get into some of this observing. And how through this observing, one learns the alchemy of transforming the baser into the higher, or as alchemy puts it, you know, transforming iron into gold. One learns this transformation process by observing. Transforming life into eternal life, and time into eternity through observing. Now, a guru such as I mentioned, Sri Ramana Maharshi, he may have an ashram, and he did, and they came there, and most of the time he didn't say anything. He was silent. But all the ashrams are different. See? There are some where maybe the guru will sit with his students. You know, and these students may come from all over. They may be Hindus and Buddhists and Christians and Muslims and believers and unbelievers all gathered there together. You know, each one carrying out his own discipline. See? Each one making his own effort. Each one having his own ideal. However he may label it. Still it is this man in the heart, this Krishna. And they learn day by day, day after day, how to live within. In such an atmosphere, one finds oneself quite alone in front of myself. One may have a given time in which they can talk with the teacher, the guru, they can ask questions, or they can just sit in meditation with him for a while. And if this is done regularly, methodically, a great deal can be gained in a few moments. The rest of the time, day and night, say they live in a house. This house is plunged in this silence of the void. Such silence, everybody going within and observing themselves in this silence until you feel that there's nobody in the house except you, though there may be 20 people, but there's nobody in this silence but you. And so one comes to realize there is only myself that is setting out to discover that I am. Now, living in very close quarters with a teacher, with a guru, the discipline can be very strict. Discipline, whatever that discipline may be, can be regarded as a wheel, the rim of which, you know, is exerting constant pressure inwards to the hub. You go within with this pressure. Go within in this pressure. You see. It exerts, you know. We are steeped in our discriminations. And we're seeking non-discrimination. We have all our prejudices and judgments, and while we're looking for a state of non-judgment, and we have our minds on an ideal, or a chosen image, let's call it, or it may be even very vague, but we have some picture, we have some concept, and you will have it until you finally come to realize that to be attached to an image, to a concept, even though it be divine to you, is very precarious. Our discriminations give rise to our contradictions because of other values that we give. Our contradictions confuse us. They confuse us as to what value to give to what. You know, there was a philosopher at one time, to add a little in here, I have to go out on a limb. He said, in this world, there is no such thing as a thing. There are only facts. There are no values in this world. Only facts. And when it comes to that other world, we have nothing but silence. That was Wittgenstein, huh? The greatest of the last of the great. He died sometime around the World War. He served in the First World War. Very difficult to read, but very worthwhile, because through it you can see this other world interpenetrating what he thinks. And of course, he is adamant about language. We don't know how to speak. We're trying to talk about that world in this world's language, and you can't do it. Anyway, we're here with this pressure now. Let's get back to the pressure. Remember this wheel, and the rim is exerting all this pressure, and this pressure builds. This guru sees that the pressure builds until such time as the tasks that we usually do, you know, they kind of lose their meaning. It's almost for us a very cruel time to go through, seemingly. But it's very necessary to live with this pressure, because finally there arises from the very depths of one's being, from the core, as it were. In opposition to this pressure from the outside of you trying to go within, you know, this new rises in the center, see, a more contained, at first maybe just a more eager impulse. There is this flowering then that comes about, the archetypal experiences. And finally, you know, out of the core there rises the man in the heart. It comes in resistance to that pressure. See? Because when all that pressure is applied and you're going within, the energy is compacting and you're feeding the spiritual side of yourself. Yeah. You know, and we have this hardened cover, this rim, huh? And it is this cover that we show the world. It is this mask that we present. And this cover that we are so sure that conceals ourselves from others. And so it also conceals ourselves from this palpitating life, you know. And the mask also conceals ourselves from ourselves. Yeah. So, and the guru says, you know, have confidence. Have confidence. Just do as you're told to do. That's what the Baal teacher says. In this way, you know, this kind of a discipline, just do as you're told. You don't ask, what should I do? What good would it do me to do what he tells me to do? You know, all kinds of rebellions against the teacher, you know. You just follow the instructions. This allows, in this pressure, this allows the beingness to have priority over the ego. That's what discipline is. Be it soft or be it hard, discipline is to allow that being to have priority over the ego. Why do we fight it so? And then when we're looking, we say, we're looking. Oh, I'm looking. Every religious tradition makes a distinction between a natural man and a spiritual man. So we have rites and we have rituals, huh? We have a bar mitzvah. We have sacraments which admit the child to join the spiritual heritage of the community. Now he is now a man and he can join. So he also joins the spiritual community. You know, the boy is to become a man and he's to join with the men community. And at this time, this child become man, you know, is to make his commitment to a spiritual discipline. And it is supposed to be voluntary. It's his setting forth of his spiritual adventure. Now, every culture has something, some kind of a rite that the boy will go through. You know, our American Indians, you know, the boy went off, he had lived with women, he lived with the women till he reaches a certain age. It's either 7 or 14, different cultures are different. And then he's sent off into the wilderness, 3 days, no food, no water, no nothing. He just goes off for these 3 days. And if it's summertime, it's not too bad if his birthday is around summertime. If his birthday is in the wintertime, he's out there in the snow and it's not so pleasant. But he's got to be out there for 3 days and then he comes back. And during those 3 days, somewhere in there, he has had a vision. And he comes back and he tells the shaman what this vision was. And from that, he gets his name. And it is also the beginning of his spiritual adventure, his way to go. It points the way he should go. All cultures have this. Now, of course, he's under discipline now. All of a sudden, you go through this, let's say it's a bar mitzvah. You come to this thing and it's one day, one afternoon affair, or one evening affair, or whatever it is. And then that's it. But he is no longer a child. He has now to act like a man. He is no longer a child. Of course, now, but this day and age, most of these rituals and these rites and all this thing have come, they're fairly artificial. Artificial. And there was a time, and there, you know, in the old days when it was taken very seriously, it meant that now you can join and be a man. And here now you were also supposed to seek. You know, I've mentioned this before, evolution. Evolution is the evolution of consciousness. We're going to evolve consciously. Conscious evolution, that's why this question becomes very important, you know, that in all the midst of your world, what about this consciousness? What about it? What is this whatever it is, that we label, that we call consciousness. What is it? What is it? Conscious is a conscious evolution is a process. And it is a deepening and a widening of consciousness, and that's the aim of spirituality. That's your spiritual search. Spiritual search is a conscious effort to grow in consciousness through assimilating and intensifying the consciousness. That simple. It is that simple. How many steps to climb? How many blind corners? How many trees in the way? sensory values of our instinctual life must be transformed into values of understanding. You know that the very power with which we handle ideas is a conscious conquest. A lot of people don't handle ideas, you know. They don't reason. Their values are all, you know, instinctual. But then to transform this into understanding, to be able to handle ideas, reasoning, you know, it's a big thing. Because ideas, after all, do point some more of the way. Sensations, you know, we all have. We can't live without them. We've got a body. We need a body in order to search. You know, they may be very clear and they may be very precise, but they are understood differently by different people. I mean, if that happens to you, you don't understand it the same way as I would, maybe, or the person sitting next to you. And of course, then the ends of the sensations bring about a very different result because of our interpretation of it. To discern and to transform training, discipline, the discipline of the mind is involved. One cannot simply do as one wants and only as one wants and thereby think you're trained. Never, never has this way ever been spoken of as hedonistic. We need to train the mind that the consciousness can come to the fore. And this people don't understand. They have not yet transformed this instinctual thing into understanding. But sensation, even though it may be incorrectly interpreted, sensations are what we have at the beginning of a search, by and large. So we go about this search in order to put our experiences in order, in a sequence, and to share our way of life, and to discover the laws of this nature in which we live. The repetition of experiences. You know, a child learning to walk, he walks two steps and he falls down. And he walks a few, but he hauls himself up and he walks a little bit and he falls down. And then finally he's learning to say mama and dada, you know. And he repeats this and repeats this. And this repetition gives him what he thinks is power of control. So he is, he's sitting there doing that, exactly. See? And so what does a child do? Who's he going to control? Mama and papa, of course. Not himself. This doesn't even occur to him yet, of course, naturally. But who's he going to control? And you watch him manipulate to do just that. And they will do it right up until the time they're 21. Why should they stop when they're 21? I don't know. See? Now, this is what our senses do for us. They allow us to think we have got this power of control. But it is a process. It is a process of creating our inner world, all our trees. For the child, at that point in time, or as long as we are so terribly sensate at this point in time, whatever that time may be for all of us, influences come from out there. And now you're going to live within. You're going to live within. So influences come from in here and not out there. You're going to give priority to something else. And always there is the admonition to observe oneself, to look into the depths of oneself, is a necessary discipline for the evolution of consciousness. This observation is the aim, an aim to be pursued in everyday life, to remain aware of what we are about, to be alert, for to all of us comes the moment, all of us comes this moment, in the midst of our occupations, there is this short-lived suspension of all the activity within and so therefore without, which brings an instant, this clarity, this insight. Now the moment may be very, very short, you know, and come and gone and you haven't caught it, but you just knew it happened. In that flash of perception, if you will watch, if you will observe, and if you will are alert, in that flash, consciousness sees what comes from out there and what comes from in here. This detecting, in order to do it, one must first of all be able to control one's thoughts. Sorry, I just lost you. You know, discipline. We can train ourselves. You know, you come and you say this, blah, 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 and I say, yes or no, I say, may say yes, and I may say no. But it is a means of discipline. But you're still going to have to discipline yourself. Because I cannot run around and hold your hands. Say, now you can do this, and now you can do that. You wouldn't like that anyway. But submission. And we submit ourselves to a discipline. We submit ourselves to a training, which we carry on by ourselves. The observations and the trying to control one's thoughts. One submits to that rather than what the ego wants. And that kind of submission is this way, or is the secret of knowledge. And you know it, and you jolly well know it. Okay? I do it. And now, may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I do thank you very much.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.